This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. Each week in this podcast, I'll talk to some of the leading thinkers and researchers, entrepreneurs and executives about things like conscious capitalism, sustainability, and business ethics, things that feel all the more urgent as we as a planet face enormous challenges, climate change, pandemics, demands for social reform. Many of these challenges brought about, some would argue, by capitalism. Each episode, each guest, will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. For those listeners who follow our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com, or follow us on social media, you know that earlier this week, I was on the University of Pennsylvania's politics podcast, Democracy Works. I talked about the involvement of corporations in politics and the democratic process. If politics is your thing, you might want to check it out. But if you think that politics is not your thing and have come here for 30 minutes of your not-so-typical business talk, let me assure you that we're not going to escape it, particularly as we head into a new presidential administration whose views on the role of business could not be more different than the last. Take a listen to how Fox Business commentator Stuart Varney sees things.
The patriotic millionaires are just a convenient prop for the socialists. They will be used as dupes.
Varney and others like him have used the S word, socialism, what our 33rd President Harry Truman rightfully called a scare word while stumping for Adlai Stevenson against Eisenhower. Truman pointed out rightly that socialism is a scare word for almost anything that helps all the people. Public power, Social Security, farm price supports, bank deposit insurance, and free and independent labor unions, which incidentally gave us the 40-hour work week, a safe workplace, and ended child labor practices. The point is, our guest today, Morris Pearl, a former BlackRock executive and chairman of Patriotic Millionaires, flips the Varney script and tells a different story about the role of money and business in a well-functioning society. Let's welcome to the What Does It Profit podcast, Morris Pearl. Morris, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be in your podcast.
Oh, well, thanks. Morris, I feel like I'm a little bit of a kindred spirit, a Wall Street escapee of sorts. You, a former executive with the investment management giant BlackRock. How do you find yourself now running Patriotic Millionaires?
A lot of the same skills are applicable. It's sort of trying to solve problems for people. And I used to solve problems for people by trying to make decisions about, you know, moving financial instruments around. And now I'm trying to solve problems for people by sort of changing the face of government. In some sense, we have much more leverage that way because changing what government does can have much more of an effect on many more people than, you know, a small change in how their money is invested. So I see it as a good thing.
So you're expanding markets, we would say.
I've moved into a new market.
There you go. Well, your organization, Patriotic Millionaires, is an organization, for those listeners who don't yet know you, of high net worth Americans, business leaders, investors, who think the country would be more politically stable and businesses more profitable if the government actually raised taxes on the wealthy. So how do you find these people?
Well, what we find is people who agree with our basic premise, which is that inequality in our nation is bad. And it's getting worse, and that if it continues getting worse, it's going to cause a problem. I mean, even more problems than it's already causing. You know, we've already seen, you know, people marching in the streets and protesting, and occasionally protests turning violent, you know, here and there. And it's not just, you know, a person was murdered in Minneapolis or Louisville or New York or somewhere. It's that millions of people feel they're being treated as second or third class citizens, and they're right. The whole system of our nation has worked in favor of a small number of people who are getting richer and richer and richer, but has not worked to help the millions of people who are not getting richer, who are having all kinds of problems because of either the pandemic or whatever. And frankly, they're not going to take it anymore. I think that those of us who are doing well, business people, investors, wealthy people in general, most of us realize that it's in our own enlightened long-term self-interest to do something about this. You know, we've seen this show play out before in, say, South Africa in the 1970s and 80s. That did not end well.
That's exactly where I was going.
We don't want that to happen in the United States, so we want to do something about it.
All right, so that gets you in the public policy space. Let's wind back the political clock just a little bit, though, and put all of this into context, because you've been working on this for a long time. Tell us about the, I guess, what you in your community of folks who are working on this call the Warren Buffett rule.
Well, Warren Buffett said it was ridiculous that he had a lower tax rate than his assistant does. Now, his assistant's doing fine. She makes over $200,000 a year being Warren Buffett's assistant. But what the thing is that she pays income taxes on her income, earned income, as she gets a salary. He pays long-term capital gains taxes. His money he makes selling his investments. So his tax rate is far below her tax rate. You know, as a long-term investor, my tax rate is, there's three brackets, zero. I get zero up to $77,000, $80,000 a year, then 15, and then 20. So my actual tax rate is in the teens, whereas almost everyone who works for a living pays far higher tax rates than I do. Particularly someone who makes as much money as I do pays about double the tax rate that I pay. And that's just not fair. And it contributes to inequality, because those of us who have money invested, every year my investments go up. I don't pay as much taxes as you do. And so my wealth goes up and up. And then every year I make more and more money from my investments, and it's compounding favorably. Whereas someone who's working for a living and just barely getting by and paying higher taxes than I pay, they don't get to save much money. A huge percentage of Americans don't even have enough money for an emergency like a flat tire or something. And then they don't get better off every year. And every year they fall farther and farther behind. And that's why people are understanding that just things are not fair for most Americans.
Sure. And then that puts business and investments squarely at the intersection of politics. I can't imagine. I mean, it's going to take a tsunami of millionaires, I think, to make a dent. I mean, I think about the House Ways and Means Committee and who those people hang out with. They're rich people. Do you see big, bold initiatives coming, maybe with a change of Congress?
Not convinced.
Let's be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to say something more optimistic. You know, I went to meet the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. I went to talk to his senior staff. I asked them about their big and bold plans, and they said that there aren't any, basically. They talked about, you know, tariffs and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think that is the problem, that they're used to hanging out with people who are very short-term oriented and who honestly believe that what's good for big business is good for America. There might be some truth to that, but I think that you have to be more long-term oriented and realize that big business or anyone else is not going to do well if they end up in a country filled with lots of poor people who are having trouble getting by.
Well, I can't afford to buy their stuff.
Exactly. I agree. Yes. I mean, our members of our Patriotic Millionaires, you know, got rich because all kinds of reasons, but some of them sold expensive ice cream. Some of them sold expensive organic groceries. Some of them sold shoes and all kinds of things that, you know, they need upper middle class people to pay for and buy. You know, we need to make money from our investments and our businesses. We need the kind of country that has millions and millions of people who pay their bills every month, their iPhone bills and their rent and everything else. A few rich people, lots of poor people, does not do it for most businesses.
Well, let's talk about businesses for a minute. What do you say to those people who say corporations don't pay taxes, people do? So don't tax the corporations. Where does that argument go with you?
Well, I mean, sure, it's true. A corporation is just a name we use for a bunch of people who are doing something together in some way or another. But in many cases, those corporations are accumulating humongous amounts of wealth, and that the people who own them, they don't extract the wealth from the corporations. They can sell their share of the corporation and sell it to someone else and get money that way. So many times this wealth can just be accumulated inside of the corporation for years and years and years and years. Now, yeah, one solution would be to tax the people who own the corporations. We'd have to get by the fact that much of this is owned by things like retirement funds and 401ks and things like that. They don't pay taxes at all. So that's one issue. And another issue is that would be a huge change in the American system, because currently the way our system works, if you own some asset, like say I own shares of stock in Amazon, for instance, which I do, I pay no taxes at all, not one penny until I sell those shares. Now, those shares are now worth, I don't know, $1 million more than I paid for them. So I have wealth of $1 million more than I did before. I could borrow hundreds of thousands of dollars against that and spend it and go on vacation or something. I could do lots of things, but I pay zero tax on that increase in wealth until I sell those shares, which I may not do. If I still hold them when I die, that income will never be taxed by anyone, because my kids will inherit the shares and they won't have to pay any tax either, even if they do sell them. So that would be a huge change. But yeah, I mean, we could make that kind of change and tax people as their investments and stock goes up. We could make them pay taxes at that level. If somehow that seems much more complicated to me to have tax and unrealized capital gains, but yeah, we could do something like that.
I'm not advocating any particular public policy. I'm just asking you to kind of stretch the margins. What do you think about the role of stock buybacks?
Well, it basically means a corporation taking some of its money and giving it to some of the shareholders so that the remaining shareholders then own a larger percentage of the company. They essentially buy out some of their co-owners. I mean, that in itself, it's not terrible. And certainly in some cases, it makes perfect sense. You know, if a company is going out of business, for instance, you want to buy back all the stock or something. But I don't think that it makes sense from our society's point of view in many cases. Some of these companies, for instance, airlines used to be regulated and operate in a very long-term kind of way. Now, since the time of the hostile takeovers in the 1970s, when Carl Icahn took over TWA, airlines have been running much more short-term. Oh, if there's anything which will generate more money for the shareholders over the next few months, we have to do that, because otherwise some corporate raiders will take over our airline, we'll all be fired. That's what the management thinks. And so that's why the airlines have been in such trouble with this COVID thing recently. They made lots of profits over the years, I mean, in recent years, but all of that money was withdrawn by the shareholders, essentially through either stock buybacks or dividends or something else. So there was no money left within the airline companies because they essentially sent it all to the owners. And that's why when something bad happened, a pandemic came along and cut down air traffic, you know, hugely, and it's still cut down, they couldn't survive without huge amounts of government assistance. So essentially, it's sort of saying to the shareholders, well, we win when things are good, but the government has to step in when things are bad. And that's just not fair. It's not right to all the other kinds of businesses where the business people kind of intelligently saw, oh, if I spend all of my money and I don't have any left for a rainy day, then when it rains, I'll be in trouble. And they didn't see that as a viable option. So they didn't spend all of their money. Well, it's kind of unfair to them to say, oh, actually, if you do spend all of your money, you're much better off, because then you'll get free money from the government later. So yeah, it's been a big problem in recent days. And the airlines are just one example.
Sure. Well, tell us how corporate taxes used to work, because, you know, I hear people say there's this, you know, friction between raising corporate taxes and the inability to hire people. So if we can't afford to hire people, it will, you know, be deleterious.
No, that doesn't make any sense.
I know, but I hear it.
The way corporations work is you sell something and make money, whether it's airline tickets or shoes or whatever. You sell something to make money. You pay your expenses. What's left is profit. Government gets a certain percentage of that profit, and the owners get the rest, or they either keep it in the corporation or withdraw it. Now, if they don't make any profit, they don't pay any taxes. If they pay people more, that reduces their taxes, because they only pay tax on the profit that's left over after the people are paid. Corporations don't pay people out of benevolence. They pay people because they need the people to do something that makes more profit. So a company only hires more people if those people will increase the company's profit. You know, you only do something if it will make you money. You don't say, oh, I mean, it doesn't make any sense on the numbers to say that, oh, if taxes are lower, then you'll hire more people. Because if taxes were lower, the owners would get more. But if they could make more profits by hiring more people, they would have done that before. And they would have made more profit at any tax rate below 100%. If that additional person could increase profits, whether tax rates are 0% or 99%, it would be economically logical to hire that person. And if it's not profitable to hire that person at one tax rate, it's not profitable to hire that person at any other tax rate either. So no, that doesn't make any sense mathematically that lowering taxes would increase hiring people.
Well, it's a very simple argument that you state very well, but I would venture to say, you know, there are always going to be people that make that argument. And I think the work that you're doing in tax policy is, you know, really important. You know, I look at what Patriotic Millionaires is working on, you know, the progressive taxation and raising the minimum wage. Tell us why that's important.
Well, I think both things are important. I mean, progressive taxation is important because if you don't have progressive taxation, you have the rich getting richer and richer and richer, and the poor getting poorer and poorer and poorer, and inequality getting worse. If people look, for instance, at flat tax, well, it really means increasing tax on poor people and decreasing tax on rich people, making the rich people get richer and the poor people get poorer. And I mean, it's mathematically possible, but I don't want that outcome. That's not what I want as a matter of my policy preference. I don't want a policy that has rich people getting richer and poor people getting poorer. So that's why I'm for a progressive tax, which would have the opposite effect. We're also supporting raising the minimum wage because the labor market, the market for labor, does not work the way that the market works for, you know, commodities like, you know, soybeans or corn or something. There's not a free market in labor. You can't find some, you know, if there's some, even if there's some employer someplace that needs more people, you can't necessarily take that job if that job is in Missouri because you live in Washington. You can't, there's lots of things you can't do. You can't hire people who don't live near you. We do not have a free market in labor now. Different people have different skills and abilities. And in many cases, only one employer that employs people with certain skills. If you're in a working in a coal mine in West Virginia or Colorado or someplace, you know, you can't go offer your labor to some other employer because there is no other employer who has a mine in that place. You know, it's not like you're a farmer selling soybeans. There's a market price for soybeans. And if you can sell your soybeans to whomever you like. So the market for labor is substantially different than the market for a commodity that's in a perfectly free market, as economists would say. So we need some regulation on that. And that's called what we call in the United States the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is colloquially called the minimum wage. We require employers to pay a certain amount of wages if they want to hire people.
Well, I guess the third pillar in your portfolio is this idea of enabling more inclusion in the political process, or maybe, I don't know if you'd say it this way, but I see it this way, kind of tamping down the unequal influence of different economic strata in the political process.
Yeah, I mean, you could say raising up the unequal influence of some strata that has less influence now. Part of the problem, as we alluded to earlier, is that our government officials, whether they're good meaning or not, and most of them are good meaning, they end up spending so much time with their donors that they kind of forget about the problems of everyone else. You know, even I was at a cocktail party here in New York City a couple of years ago, and I remember a United States senator saying, oh, it's a good thing I'm not a self-funder like this other candidate is, because it's only at things like this that I actually get to talk to real people. And I thought to myself, you're at a party in a penthouse apartment in Manhattan, nowhere near the state where you live, and you think you're talking to real people. It's just kind of ridiculous. But they do it for so many years, they honestly believe it. And it's true.
I'm hearing campaign finance reform. I'm hearing term limits. Is that the kind of thing?
Campaign finance reform, yes. I don't think term limits make sense because, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily someone who's been in office a long time is less qualified than someone else. Frankly, I think it's the other way around in many cases, that the people who have been in office for longer are actually older and wiser. But putting that aside for a minute, I think what we have here in New York City has worked fairly well. We used to have a city council that was dominated by frankly, people who were brothers-in-laws of real estate developers. Now we don't. The difference is that we have a system where if someone wants to run for city council, if they get a couple hundred people to each donate $100 or $200, then the city will give them some matching funds. And like $200,000. But with that $200,000, they can have a viable campaign and run for office. And that works great. So that law, at a tiny expense, in looking at our city budget, where the percentages are 0.00, it's listed as 0% of the budget. It's less than 1/100 of 1% goes to this program. But it's changed the face of City Hall, or changed the faces in City Hall. And therefore, it's really change the policies that we get, because the people who like are renters now have some representation in the city council, not just the people who are landlords. And so, yes, there are some rich people in the city council too, and that's fine. Rich people can run for office if they want to, but not everyone. You don't have to be a rich person now. And we support what's in HR 1, which passed the House a while ago, that has a system similar to that for the United States Congress. The idea being that you would get a bunch of small donations and then get some matching funds instead of having to get, you know, these multi-$1,000 donations from a few rich donors. And so that would mean the candidates would not have to spend all their time in these little phone booths at, you know, 430 South Capitol Street anymore. They'd get to spend more of their time actually talking to the rest of the people in the district who don't have the ability to make these $1,000 donations.
Well, tell us more about the Tax the Rich conference.
We did the first conference last year in April in Washington, D.C. The second one was in November in San Francisco and Valencia Street. And basically, we got a bunch of people to explain these very issues that we're talking about now, sort of why are the taxes so much less on the rich and what can we do about it? Some were elected officials, some were academics. Some were journalists. And each of these conferences, we really invited a lot of people to explore what's happening. Now, we can't do big in-person events anymore. We've done 14 smaller conferences, each one with a different member of Congress, mostly in the House, a few senators. We've done, I think, 14 so far. We have a few more scheduled over the next few months. But we'll probably schedule more after people are less busy with the election stuff. At each one, we've done a presentation about sort of the most egregious aspects of our tax code and why it is so unfair and why rich investors have so much lower tax rates to pay than people that have to work for a living. And then we've had an open discussion with our audience and members of Congress who are interested in this. So the result is that more people are talking about tax policy. And more people are talking about why do we have this tax policy that particularly with the new laws in 2017, when the Republicans were in charge of both parts of Congress, have we made it so much worse in terms of causing more inequality? And so that's what we've been doing. And that's one of the main things the Patriotic Millionaires has been doing over the past few months. And we'd be happy to do more of these conferences if any of your listeners, want to engage in it.
Well, we will make sure we put a link in the show notes to the to your website so
sure.
we can have an easy avenue for our listeners to find you. Well, you also have a book coming out in the spring. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, we have put together a book. It's called Tax the Rich. It's in copy edit stage now. It'll be published in April by tax day, April 15th, the day that normal tax returns are due. Now you can pre-order it on Amazon. It's being published by the New Press, which is a publishing company here in New York City. And we have basically explained why the tax system is so unfair to so many Americans and why we have to do something about it. So we're hoping more people read the book. You can read the book. You can go to the conference. You can listen to us talk. You can call on the phone. But that's sort of the message we're trying to put out by every different means of putting out messages, that the tax system is currently unfair in favor of rich people. It's taxing rich people at lower rates, and it's making the rich richer and everyone else not. And if we don't do something about it, we're going to have our country not be the same country for our grandchildren as the country that we grew up in. And that's what we're worried about.
Well, Morris, I have a feeling that this is not a uniquely American experience. We have obviously our own laws and regulations, but this dynamic, I think, crosses cultures and is really kind of a bigger world problem. Is that where we're headed with Millionaires for Humanity?
Well, yeah. I mean, people have realized this in other countries too, of course. You know, in the United Kingdom, you know, has actually changed their tax system over the past generations. And they have less of a landed aristocracy now than they did some years ago. So we have gotten some interest from people in the United Kingdom and Denmark about, you know, the same kinds of problems in other countries as we have here. We are expanding a bit. We're just sort of helping the people in Denmark and the United Kingdom and other European countries do the kind of things that we've been doing. We've been working with the United Nations. We've been working with Oxfam. And basically, we're just sort of encouraging and aiding rich people in other countries to speak out in the same kind of way that we've been speaking out here in the United States, because, you know, many countries have kind of similar problems. So we've recently engaged a person in the United Kingdom to work on this full time and get people in other countries more engaged. We've done an event in connection with the World Economic Forum at Davos, Switzerland. And yeah, it's expanding. People all over the place are realizing that the rich getting richer and the poor getting whatever is not a good thing.
Well, I guess you've already answered my question, but I have to ask it because I ask it for everyone who sits on the other side of the microphone for me. Morris, the work that you do in trying to create a more sustainable economy by trying to balance out these gross inequities, what does it profit? What's the benefit?
Well, I mean, the benefit for me is that I'm hopefully going to assist my young granddaughter in having the same opportunities that I had when I was growing up, the same opportunities to have a country where she can start a profession or start a business or invest money or do things and grow up with the kind of opportunities that I had. I'm afraid of it turning out to be, you know, the opposite way around and the United States going the wrong way and ending up being some kind of kleptocracy with a few rich people and lots of poor people. And that's what I'm trying to avoid. And I have the good fortune of working with a great team of people. I think we have 17 paid staff now at our Patriotic Millionaires, and they're just a bunch of wonderful people. They make me feel old when I realize that, you know, they're like around the age of my kids, and, you know, they weren't even born.
Morris, you don't see me here in the studio, but I'm laughing because I've got an army of interns who are working on the show who teach me about tech, and you probably have similar experiences as I do. I look back at the beginning of my banking career where I was jet setting to Sacramento to get bond allocation to sell muni bonds to the newly rich high-tech moguls in the dot-com era. So that makes me. So I feel you. All right. Morris, thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for stepping away from a brilliant investment career to do this work, because it's important work. And I'm glad we can share it with our audience.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You're helping too.
This is What Does It Profit? Links to resources related to the issues we've discussed in this episode are in the show notes. Tell us what you think in a rating and review on your favorite podcast app. It really does help. More information about the show can be found at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. In our next episode, how one company is providing investors new ways to help close the wealth gap. CNotes' Kat Berman.
We should all have access to financial freedom or economic independence, and that should be regardless of who your parents are, what zip code you were born into, right? The opportunity to really experience economic security, right, should be available to all Americans.
In the meantime, let your friends know about the show. Quick sharing links can be found on our website. We would love to hear from you. Show ideas and comments are always welcome. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at WDIP Podcast. What Does It Profit Podcast is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. The show is produced by Jordan Gaspour. Executive producers are Nate Toby and Barbara Landis. Special thanks to our talented interns, Nate, Niels, Hannah, and Andrew, and our friends at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, Business for Impact, the Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation, the DC Chapter of Conscious Capitalism, and Switchinboard Studios. And a special shout out to our friends at Castbox for adding us to their staff favorites list. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?